This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. And our melting pot of ingredients today includes a drum, a clock, and a map, spiced up with a lewd book, a gruesome execution, some canes, and glass eyes, all in the name of antiques and art. We will also dish up a miraculous find, and a not-so-miraculous, it seems, restitution, and a suggestion for an alternative use for some of Australia's institutional historic buildings, perhaps to coincide with next year's Mardi Gras. Stay tuned on and tuned in. We'll start with two items sold locally at auction in Sydney at Leonard Joel's on the 25th of February. Both served a purpose, perhaps more poignantly in the past than today. But do things really need to be useful? Both items retain their interest, curiosity, and their own beauty, as well as being a slice of history. The first is the opening lot of the sale, lot number one, a drum, but not just any old drum. Lot number one, the Duke of Wellington drum. It is reputed that the drum was once owned by the Duke of Wellington. It was used by military religious padres during drumhead services on various battlefields in Europe. These padres have signed the drum, and it is believed it also contains a signature of William IV. It was made in England in the 19th century. The diameter is 72 centimetres and the height 72 centimetres. And the details come with the provenance. By repute, the Duke of Wellington, Apsley House, London, gifted to the 1st Earl of Ancaster, Gilbert Heathcote Drummond Willoughby of Grimthorpe Castle, England. By descent to the 2nd Earl of Ancaster, Gilbert James Heathcote Drummond Willoughby, Grimthorpe Castle, England, gifted to the Reverend P.J. Hayes, and by descent to the current owner in Sydney. And it sold for just slightly under $3,000 all up. No mention of drumsticks, but you probably wouldn't want to beat it anyway. The second item is lot 15 in the sale, a long case clock, better known to most as a grandfather clock. These are attractive and take up very little space. Lovely to have even if they're not working. I know, because I've got one at home. Here's what Joel's had to offer. What am I bid for? Lot 15. A mid-18th century mahogany long case clock by R. Jackson of Hexham. Of elegant proportions, the top with swan pediment and fluted columns, capped in gilt brass, with an elaborately engraved and embossed gilt brass face in Rococo motifs, and signed by the maker R. Jackson, Hexham. The case in mahogany, veneered on pine and cross-banded in rosewood, with ebony and satinwood stringing, and inlaid with walnut details. England, circa 1750, height 209 centimetres. And all up it sold for just a smidgen under $1,000. Now, two significant factors influence price with grandfather clocks, and what we don't know about in relation to lot 15 is whether the clock is working, and secondly, if it's a 24-hour clock or the more desirable 8-day clock. Do you need to wind it up every day or every week? You'd need to view the sale or check that one out. In my situation with a 24-hour clock, I forget to wind it up anyway and I don't even know if it works, which it probably doesn't, but I still love it, and someone no doubt will love lot 15. But let's move from time to motion. Getting from A to B today is probably a case of Google Maps. No need to read, just listen to the voice directions. How different things were in the 16th century, and how important it was to own and be able to read a map, not just for local fishermen and coastal transport, but for defenders, and of course invaders. So let's see what the Antique Trade Gazette on page 8 on the 29th of February has to offer. Its pick of the week is Coastal Map Creates a Scottish Trailblazer. La Navigation du Roi d'Écosse by the French cartographer Nicolas de Nicolay, 1517-1583, is said to be the oldest accurate map of coastal Scotland. Drawn following a voyage James V took to the limits of his dominion in 1540, a copy of the first printing made in 1583 sold for £55,000 under the hammer, that's about $125,000 all up, on February the 19th. The buyer was an international dealer. Fittingly, the sale of rare books, manuscripts, maps and photographs auction was conducted by Lyon and Turnbull in Edinburgh. In the 16th century, this chart would have termed a rutter, from the French routier, the term used for a set of sailing directions. Rutters were typically secretive documents as they contained important navigational information. In this case, nearly 200 observations about Scottish tidal conditions, coastal havens, sounds and hazards. As Nicolay writes in his dedication, La Navigation largely follows a plan drawn by Alexander Lindsay, the little-known pilot of a voyage taken by James V in 1540 to subdue the unruly lords of the Western Isles. It seems that a version of Lindsay's original manuscript map had fallen into the hands of the English politician and general John Dudley, he of Lady Jane Grey fame, who allowed Nicolay to make a copy. The rudder was put to good use in July 1547 when a fleet of 16 French galleys navigated to St Andrews and laid siege to the castle. John Knox was amongst those taken prisoner. Also in 1559, when French troops were sent north in support of the regency of Mary of Guise. That the map was finally printed in Paris in 1583 was not coincidental. It followed intrigue between the Spanish and French that mooted an attack via Scotland to put Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, on the English throne. Admired today for these insights into the 16th century espionage and international relations, it also stands as a shining example of the age's cartography. Remarkably, the map remained the most precise statement of the Scottish coastline until the 18th century, more accurate than Joan Blow and Robert Gordon's map of 1654 or Herman Moll's map of 1714. And that was written by Roland Arkell. And staying with the printed word, but moving to something very different, we have a piece from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 29th of February, Executions in Grisly Detail. Two broadsides describing and illustrating with wood engravings the executions of convicted murderers were sold online at £1,600 apiece by Forum. That of 1862, which is illustrated, features Constance or Catherine Wilson, the last woman to be publicly hanged in London. A live-in nurse, she was accused of poisoning a patient after first persuading her to alter her will. Though initially acquitted of that charge, she was rearrested before she had left the court and charged with 7 similar murders, though was eventually tried and found guilty on only one count. The other broadside, dated 1860, concerned the trial and execution of a man called Mullins for the murder of Mary Ensley, a landlady and rent collector. Too late for poor Mullins. Doubts were subsequently raised about the truth of the charges brought against him. And that was from the Antique Trade Gazette, and raises the question, what does history tell us, and what do we learn from it? Was this document bought by an opponent of capital punishment, a collector of old documents, a necro-historian, or, well, I don't know, perhaps history will tell? The printed word, which is such an excellent source of history, produces something very different, and this comes from the pen of Ian MacKay from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 25th of January. Lewd Awakenings in Sale Rooms. Known among colleagues as the Laird of Lewd, for the surprising number of erotic works he's unearthed for auction in recent times, Jim Spencer, the book specialist at Hanson's, has underlined that talent once again. This time it was a rare pocket guide to London's prostitutes, which was offered as part of the opening book section of the December 12th to 13th sale held at Bishton Hall in Staffordshire. The Man of Pleasure's illustrated pocketbook for 1850 sold for much higher than predicted £4,000. This work contained 50 sketches and descriptions of ladies of the night, complete with notes on their specialities and attractions. Disguised in a wallet-style binding, this complete and gentlemanly night guide makes use of coded language and assorted equestrian and seafaring terms in its descriptions of the particular attractions and accomplishments of the ladies of the night who grace its pages. Here, for the sake of decency, I shall quote, and that's Ian McKay quoting, just one of the more restrained of those passages drawn to my attention by the sale room. It concerns a Miss Fowler, who, when stepping into a cab or coach, makes the most of her leg, and in an omnibus generally sets fire to all male passengers, so that you see them fidgeting and adjusting their rebellious members the rest of the journey. On a more sobering note, this rarity also features a section on the health of the man of pleasure that offers descriptions of sexually transmitted diseases and precautions to be taken, among them some unlikely home remedies. This rarity has been estimated at just £300 to £500 in acknowledgement of its lack of a cover and somewhat stained condition. Let's go from the printed word now to the screen. That's the television screen and the big screen. Who remembers Wicker Man, that scary film? Or the television series Callan? Then, if you do, you'll remember Edward Woodward. And this article relates to him and comes from the Antique Trade Gazette from the 25th of January. Woodward walking canes on a stroll. The New Year's Day sale at Clark's in Liscard included a collection of walking canes collected by the late actor Edward Woodward. Consigned by his actress widow Michelle Dutrice, who lives locally, it included sword sticks and other canes with concealed accoutrements, perhaps appealing to an actor who found TV fame in the 60s and 70s as the spook Callan. The provenance undoubtedly enhanced interest in a field already popular with online buyers, said auctioneer Paul Clark. Top seller from the Woodward collection was a 3-foot-1-inch, that's 94 centimetre, long Malacca cane with a double-bladed sword and a hammer handle, which took £190. It tripled expectations, as did a 2-foot-9.5-inch, that's 63 centimetre, long Japanese bamboo example with chased blade, which went to another private buyer at £140. From a different source came a Briggs of London Malacca cane with a London 1904 12.5 carat gold knob inscribed Cosmo Duff Gordon Travellers Club. Duff Gordon's claim to fame, or infamy, was that he survived the sinking of the Titanic. Accusations, stoutly denied, were made that he had jumped the queue of women and children to join his wife in a lifeboat and bribed the oarsman to row the half-empty boat away from the scene without hanging around to pick up other survivors. Any connection, noble or ignoble, to the Titanic puts a huge premium on any artefacts, so faking is now a problem, noted Clarks. However, a letter showed that before his death in 1931, Duff Gordon had given the stick to his housekeeper, Isabella Whale, the vendor's great-grandmother. This was proof enough for a Titanic specialist bidding for a client, and the stick pitched at £300 to £500 sold at £7,400. That's something in the region of 15,000 Australian dollars. And now from canes to cabinets, from the same Antique Trade Gazette of the 25th of January. And this is called An Eye-Catching Lot. The limited but international appeal of this remarkable collection of about 350 Victorian hand-painted glass eyes was clear at East Bristol Auctions. in a mahogany cabinet originally from one of the earlier stores owned by Bristol-based Dunscombe Opticians, each of the 9 drawers denoted by colour of the eye, some of the prosthetics were catalogued as AF, that's faulty, but most were in good original condition. Estimated at £800 to £1,200 at the December the 17th sale, the collection caught the attention of a number of bidders, up to about £1,500. Phone bidders then took over, and a German buyer finally saw victory at £3,600, about £12 per orb, taking the premium into account. Thank you, Antique Trade Gazette, and compare that result with your medical health fund coverage for glass eyes. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. And now here's something to amuse you, or stop you getting bored. A remarkable story about a remarkable find, and this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 8th of February, and it's entitled Board from a Bomb Site. As soon as the vendor pulled the board from her bag, I recognised something of serious interest. Tom Blest, general manager and auctioneer at Catherine Southern Auction House, first saw the late 16th century South German rosewood and bone gaming board at a valuation day in Tunbridge Wells. The vendor had little idea of its date or rarity, but recalled finding it in a scrap heap in an area of bombed-out London in the 1960s. Her mother had sent her out to look for firewood. Remarkably, it is a full set, complete with its 30 counters or table men, each engraved with a portrait roundel of classical and biblical figures, one probably a later replacement. The board inlaid for chess, backgammon and 9 men's Morris has similar rosettes, 3 now absent, that are probably based on the work of the influential Nuremberg printmaker Virgil Solis, 1514 to 1562. It was probably made in Augsburg, circa 1590. A similar games board without tablemen is in the collection of the Victoria and Albert Museum. The similarity of the corner roundels suggests a close relationship between the two boards, and perhaps even the same workshop. It was a pleasure to tell the astonished vendor that her old board game, stored under the sofa, was worth a 5-figure sum, and that a similar example exists in a museum, said Blest. The board has been given an estimate of £10,000 to £20,000 and will be offered at Catherine Southern's sale on February the 26th at the Farley Court Golf Club in Surrey, writes Roland R. Kell. And in actual fact, it hammered down at £30,000, which all up, with buyer's premium, is something in the vicinity of $65,000 Australian. But what is 9 Men's Morris? A very large English saloon car? For the answer, we turn to Old Faithful Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable, 14th edition, and we look under the heading of Morris. 9 Men's Morris, an ancient game similar to draughts, once popular with shepherds, still found in East Anglia and either played on a board or on flat green sward. 2 persons each have 9 pieces or men, which they place down alternately on the spots. And there's a diagram here which looks rather like a square spider's web. And the aim of either player is to secure a row of 3 men on any line on the board and to prevent his opponent achieving this by putting one of his own men on a line which looks like being completed, etc. Strutt says, the rustics, when they have not materials at hand to make a table, cut the lines in the same form upon the ground and make a small hole for every dot. And Brewers also gives us a quote from Shakespeare, and this comes from A Midsummer Night's Dream. The fold stands empty in the drowned field, and crows are fatted with the murrain flock. The 9 Men's Morris is filled up with mud. And staying with Shakespeare, or at least the idea of stage dramas being a comedy, a tragedy, or historical, how about this? Or perhaps it's a bit of all three. Or is it a whodunit, or a new category altogether called Who Got Done? This comes from theartnewspaper.com on the 2nd of March and was written by Gareth Harris. Stolen ancient sculpture returned to Nigeria is the kind of fake you could buy on eBay, African art expert says. Specialists in ancient African art say that a bronze Ife sculpture returned recently from Mexico to Nigeria is fake. The piece depicting a man in a headdress sitting cross-legged was recently seized at the airport in Mexico City. Specialists at the National Institute of Anthropology and History, an agency affiliated with the Mexican government's Ministry of Culture, helped identify the artifact as a 6th-century piece hailing from the ancient Yoruba kingdom in southwestern Nigeria. The piece was handed to Nigeria's ambassador to Mexico, Amino Iyor, in a special ceremony last week. The sculpture and its provenance were authenticated by experts and agencies of both countries, with the participation of specialists from the National Institute of Anthropology and History. It has been exported illegally, says a statement issued by the Mexican government. But Julian Volper, a curator at the Royal Museum for Central Africa in Tervuren, Belgium, tells the art newspaper, "I confirm that object is a fake and of the worst quality. You can find a lot of the same type of object on eBay. This story is ridiculous and a shame for Mexico." A Paris-based dealer adds that the work is an airport-quality rough copy. Yves Bernard Deby, a Brussels-based lawyer specialising in cultural property and trade, says that the repatriation to Nigeria took place against the backdrop of the ongoing restitution debate linked to African art. This demonstrates once again the haste with which governments handle the fashionable issue of restitution, disregarding legal historical facts, he says. The National Institute of Anthropology and History did not respond for a request to comment at the time of writing. The Embassy of Mexico in Nigeria also did not respond to a request for comment. So who done it and who got done? Well, here are some other doings. And this comes from Hannah McGiven in the March edition of the art newspaper. Hidden LGBTQ histories of London's royal palaces to come out in new guided tours. The repressed LGBTQ histories of the Tower of London, Hampton Court Palace and Kensington Palace are coming out this year in a series of immersive tours scripted by an award-winning playwright. "You have 1,000 years of history in the properties we care for, so there's no shortage of stories we can tell," says Matthew Story, a curator for the UK charity Historic Royal Palaces, who is developing the performances in collaboration with playwright Chris Bush and theatre director Tom Latter. Known as Queer Lives, the series builds on LGBTQ history tours piloted at Hampton Court and the Tower of London in 2017, marking the 50th anniversary of the partial decriminalisation of male homosexuality in England and Wales. This year's more theatrical events are taking what we've learned to the next level, Story says. Working with Chris and Tom and great actors means that not only will visitors get great history, but a lot of emotion and humour in there as well. A drag raven, inspired by the Tower of London's legendary guardians, will preside over 14 evening performances at the former prison in February, LGBT History Month. Animating Stories research on figures such as Piers Gaveston, Edward II's rumoured lover, who was executed by noblemen for his closeness to the king. The hour-long tour, ticketed at £25, also unearthed the 1918 court case of a soldier at the Tower charged with cross-dressing and deserting the army, who was mocked in the newspapers for adopting a female identity. Because so many records survive for men, LGBTQ history can skew a bit heavily to male same-sex attraction, Story notes. The Tower might skew a little male as a very military institution. He hopes that the palace tours scheduled on Sundays the 19th of April to the 10th of May at Hampton Court and the 28th of June to the 26th of July at Kensington Palace will also address stories of desire between women and people who didn't identify with the male or female binary. Hampton Court, for instance, offers the real history behind the 2018 film The Favourite, which dramatised Queen Anne's passionate relationship with two ladies in waiting. Although Historic Palace's LGBTQ initiatives have ignited heated debate on social media, Story says the response from attendees of past tours has been overwhelmingly positive. I think it is really powerful to show that no matter your gender or sexuality, a place like the Tower of London is absolutely welcoming and wants to put these stories in their proper place. Thank you, Hannah McGiven. So, are there any ideas for Australia there? What could we do with Government House in Sydney's Botanic Gardens or Melbourne's Royal Exhibition Building? And, well, there are quite a few other places. But let's stay with stage performances, and we go to the Antique Trade Gazette of the 25th of January. Classic Dealer Play Back on Stage. The classic antiques dealer play, Quinny's, returns to the stage this year more than a century after it was first performed. The one-off show is part of Sold, the Year of the Dealer, Antique Dealers, Art Markets and Museums, funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. It takes place on the 28th of March at Witham in Barnard Castle, County Durham. Tickets for the show, including a drinks reception, can be bought via thewitham.org.uk for £5. English author Horace Vachell introduced the fictional dealer Joseph Quinny in 1914. The play was popular and was performed regularly until the 1950s. Two films were released and at least 20 real dealerships of the same name sprang up across the country. One is still trading in Warwick. Sold, the Year of the Dealer, aims to share the history of the antiques trade through the public events and was launched by Mark Westgarth of the University of Leeds. And I wonder if Quinny's has ever been performed in Australia. If you know the answer, please do let me know. And finally, a reminder that Nine Men's Morris doesn't have anything to do with Morris dancing. And if you don't know what Morris dancing is, once again, I direct you to that excellent book, Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable, where it states, "It's a dance popular in England in the 15th century and later, in which the dancers often represented characters from the Robin Hood stories, see Maid Marian, etc. It was commonly part of the May games and other pageants and festivals, and the dancers were adorned with bells. It was brought from Spain in the reign of Edward III and was originally a military dance of the Moors or Moriscos, hence its name." That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.